From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Tensions mount in East Timor between multinational forces and local Indonesian soldiers. We'll get a live update on the ground from a reporter in Dili. And as NBC edits out a racial slur, Latino organizations boycott major networks because faces of color are missing from this season's lineup. North Carolina Congressmember Mel Watt introduces legislation that allows states to elect more than one representative to a district. And as rallies continue in Yugoslavia, Jeremy Scahill will join us with the latest War and Peace report. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Gunfire rattled across the ravaged city of Dili, East Timor today, sending international peacekeepers nervously chasing gunmen they believed were hostile militiamen or Indonesian soldiers. No contact was made, no one hurt, but a series of shooting incidents, the first since the multinational force arrived Monday, and reports of militias gathering in West Timor raised tensions and dissipated the peacekeepers' warm welcome. Australian Major General Peter Cosgrove, the commander of the peacekeeping force, warned that his men would shoot to kill if they ran into more armed challenges to the foreigners' authority. A British officer said Indonesian soldiers on trucks opened fire. The U.S. Justice Department launched a multi-billion-dollar lawsuit against the tobacco industry yesterday, accusing the world's largest cigarette companies of conspiring to defraud and mislead the public for more than 40 years. The lawsuit filed in Washington seeks to recover medical costs for treating smoking-related conditions paid by the federal government over the past 6 years, as well as a potentially huge sum representing, quote, the disgorgement of ill-gotten gains dating back to the 1950s. Janet Reno, U.S. Attorney General, said for more than 45 years, the cigarette companies conducted their business without regard to the truth, the law, or the health of the American people. She said it has been a campaign designed to preserve their enormous profits, whatever the cost in human lives, human suffering, and in medical resources. The state of Florida is suing the nation's third-largest drugstore chain for allegedly overcharging customers for prescription drugs. Racketeering charges against Rite Aid accuse the company of automatically programming cash registers with two sets of prices, one for insured customers and one for uninsured customers. Florida Attorney General Bob Butterworth's office says the average overcharge was $1.15 for each prescription, amounting to $100,000 over a two-year period. And Frank Gifford crashed a news conference yesterday to defend wife Kathy Lee Gifford from new accusations that her clothing line is manufactured at a Central American sweatshop. The NFL Hall of Famer and former ABC Monday Night Football commentator got misty-eyed when he complained that the criticism his wife drove his children to tears. Labor advocates charged his wife contracted with a Salvadoran sweatshop that employed underage workers. Charles Kernighan of the New York-based National Labor Committee said, "I think we should think a little bit about the children working, the 13-year-old children working." The National Labor Committee and United Students Against Sweatshops charge that the Caribbean Apparel Factory in Santa Ana, El Salvador, paid workers 60 cents an hour for 11-hour, 6-day weeks in sweltering heat with no fresh water. We'll have more on that story on Monday when Charlie Kernighan and some of the workers from the plant join us. The situation of women and girls in much of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union has spiraled downward since the collapse of communism, with increasing joblessness and abuse and deteriorating social services. This according to the United Nations Children's Fund. The fund studied 27 countries in the region, examining a range of social and economic issues affecting women and girls, and concluded that while communist policies did not guarantee sexual equality, women are generally worse off now. An international scientific team stands on the brink of one of the most significant milestones in biology, deciphering the entire genetic code of a human chromosome. The scientists based at the Wellcome Trust Sanger Center near Cambridge, England, have worked out the sequence of DNA letters that make up chromosome 22. It's a big step toward working out the whole human genome, the book of life. The Human Genome Project, a $3 billion international endeavor, expects to complete a working draft of 90% of our DNA by next spring. But the Chromosome 22 team, as the Financial Times put it, has sprinted ahead of the pack. After a second bomb exploded in less than a month at Florida's historically black university, some students said they no longer feel safe going to classes or even staying in their dorm rooms. However, others vowed to return to class at Florida A&M University today, saying that staying away would mean a victory for whoever made racist telephone threats before and after the blast. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we speak throughout the show, we're trying to make contact on the ground with Dili, East Timor, to speak to a reporter there. By the way, right now, Western reporters are particularly under attack as the Indonesian soldiers and militia, bullies that they are, instead of going after the multinational forces, though they are occasionally opening fire, are going after the unarmed Westerners. Yesterday, the latest news, the killing of a Financial Times reporter, an Irish reporter was shot at, and two other reporters, an American photographer and a British newspaper person, were also attacked. We will try to reach the reporter on the ground, and if we get through, we will go directly to Dili. But right now, we're going to start off with Yugoslavia, because this reporter is in the studio with us. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeremy.
Thank you, Amy.
Well, Jeremy, we've been reading a lot over the last few days about the latest news from Yugoslavia. Number of protests taking place, street protests intended to oust Slobodan Milosevic, appear to falter on their second day. That's how the Times is putting it, giving some comfort to a government deeply shaken by the loss of Kosovo. What is your understanding of the latest? Jeremy Scahill, folks, for those of you who aren't regular listeners, has been in Yugoslavia for the last number of months, bringing us, during the bombing, a daily War and Peace report, and afterwards talking about the aftermath. He's here for a few weeks. Jeremy, what's your observation of what we're seeing there?
Well, I think we have to go beyond sort of just the obvious layers of why less and less people are showing up at demonstrations in Yugoslavia, and actually go back and look at American foreign policy toward Yugoslavia, because Yugoslavia classically fits into a pattern that the United States has with its foreign policy, both militarily and economically. The last 10 years in Yugoslavia, the United States more or less has implemented an unprecedented regime of sanctions, perhaps only second to Iraq and Cuba right now in the world. And with that, you also had 78 days of intensive airstrikes. Now, those airstrikes, we would hear all the time that they were hitting oil refineries, that they were hitting electrical grids. Well, now we're starting to see the effects of that in Yugoslavia. We're seeing the fact that people all across Serbia are going to face a winter with absolutely no heat. in a lot of instances. That includes hospitals, nursing homes, daycare centers, because their heating system depends on their electrical system, and NATO heavily bombed the electrical system. Then the backup to that would be generators, but you need fuel for generators, and NATO bombed a lot of the oil refineries, a lot of the processing plants for that fuel. So people are having to import fuel from Romania, and it's very expensive on the black market. So what we're seeing right now is a population of people who are worried very deeply about the winter, and I think the last thing on their minds right now is going to the streets and demonstrating, because they're having to face the reality that they're going to have a winter with no heat. So I think we have to look at the U.S. responsibility in subverting what could be a democracy movement.
Jeremy, in the last week, U.S. News and World Report put out a report on NATO generals saying that the bombing was a failure.
Well, I mean, it all depends on how you view what America's real policy was in Yugoslavia. I mean, militarily, it may have been a failure for them, but what they did is they did a very similar thing that happened in Iraq, and certainly what continues to happen in Iraq. They really targeted the civilian infrastructure of that country. I mean, there were, if you look at the target patterns, there were direct hits on things with no foreseeable military value whatsoever. So I think if you have a cynical, or some would say honest, view of American foreign policy, you would say that it was successful because they punished innocent people, and Milosevic remains in power. And what the United States is doing right now is Richard Gelbart, who was just named as ambassador to Indonesia, has been working very, very hard with members of the so-called democratic opposition in Yugoslavia, giving them their marching orders. And the results of that, you see, is people like Zoran Djindjic, one of the leading so-called opposition figures in the country, is not clear that they would arrest Milosevic after they took power. And I think that could be traced back to Richard Gelbart. They're also talking about a greater integration with Western Europe, bringing in the IMF, bringing in the World Bank, but they're not very good when you ask them, well, what about Brazil? What about Haiti? What about the Philippines? What about places where the IMF has subverted the poorest of the poor, has made their lives even more miserable? And actually, I had a chance to talk to Zoran Djindjic about why the so-called democratic opposition in the country is attacking Milosevic right now on the issue of the electricity, when people all across the Western media say that it's impossible to rebuild it before winter. They're criticizing him for that, and they're not criticizing NATO. So I asked Zoran Djindjic why it was that they were criticizing Milosevic and not the United States and other NATO countries for the situation with electricity. You're listening to Zoran Djindjic, head of the Democratic Party in Yugoslavia.
Isolated, they can feel some kind of solidarity with Milosevic.
Won't this make it difficult to sell to people here an idea of integrating with Western Europe? I mean, we saw the 78 days of intense bombing, and now we see under KFOR UN auspices Serbs being murdered and pushed out of Kosovo. How do you still sell a pro-West form of government here?
I believe we have here one important gap between the people and the style of life, daily life of people and government. The people in the personal daily life, the people have European values, Western values. They want to have private property, jobs, money, to travel. And but the government is anti-European, and I believe the majority of people would vote pro-European. It means to be part of Europe. It means to have a normal life, to be as citizens of Hungary, Czech Republic, and to have chance in the future. But the government and with manipulated elections, the government stopped this development, and it is the reason for us to move the people on the streets and to create the situation in which the people can express their wishes about future without manipulation. I believe we can have 100,000 and millions of people on the streets fighting for European values, for European integration, and to show the whole world that the majority of Serbs in Serbia is against this government and for European integration of Serbia.
And last question is a short one, Mr. Dzindzic. If you were to take power, or you were to be elected president, or opposition forces in this country were to take power, would you advocate the arrest of Mr. Milosevic?
We will cooperate with Hague Tribunal. We will cooperate with the UNO, with Security Council. We will cooperate with the international organization. We will be part. We intend to be a partner of this institution, and we cannot reject cooperation with this institution. It is too late for Mr. Milosevic now to demand a special status for him for himself. It is in interest of the country is to be a part of United Nations, and Hague Tribunal is organization grounded by Security Council. And we accept these institutions.
Would you order the police to arrest Milosevic and extradite him?
It is too concrete the question. It is enough to say we will cooperate, and we will find a solution in cooperation with these institutions.
Was Zoran Dzindzic, president of the Democratic Party, the group right now that is at the center of leading these protests against Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. I think that when people are looking now in the press and they're reading about Yugoslavia, we can't forget NATO's bombing. We can't forget NATO's bombing as the winter approaches and the people of many, many cities in Yugoslavia, some of them were held by the so-called opposition, were held by democratic forces. They're also going to be living and suffering during this winter. The hospitals aren't going to have medicines. They're not going to have electricity. There are going to be incubators that shut down in the middle of the nights. And so I think that whatever we're reading in the press, we always have to bring it back to NATO's responsibility, the 78 days of bombing, and the sanctions.
Jeremy Scahill, thanks for being with us. Jeremy will be bringing us reports through next week, just before he goes back to Yugoslavia, on the latest conditions there. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In a few minutes, we usually break for stations to identify themselves, but because we have reached Dili right now, East Timor, we're going to try to go to that first. BJ Habibie, the ruler of Indonesia, said today Indonesia will end martial law in East Timor immediately and hand over security to the multinational force as soon as possible. The reports that the Indonesian military commander in East Timor could leave with his forces by the weekend. However, tensions continue to mount in Dili, the capital, between the UN Australian-led forces and the Indonesian military. A commander of the United Nations forces in East Timor accused the Indonesian soldiers of shooting near his troops in Dili, raising fears of another explosion of violence. Concerns that local Indonesian forces and the military-backed militias may be trying to ratchet up tensions and test the peacekeepers. Meanwhile, UN forces in East Timor said today they found 8 bodies dumped in a well, the latest horror to emerge from the Indonesian regime's violence. As the body count mounts, the European Union says it'll call on the UN to set up an international inquiry to establish responsibility for atrocities committed in East Timor by the military and its militias. We're joined now by Marie-Pierre Vérot, who is a freelance journalist reporting for Radio France International in Dili, East Timor. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Marie-Pierre.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what is the situation on the ground now?
Well, for sure, the security has not been brought back to Dili, the capital, and will certainly not be brought back, as the Interfaith is saying, before some months. The patrols have been intensified. At the moment, there are helicopters surrounding the town. It's night here. Today, there was some tension when some shots were fired in different parts of the town at the same time by military, by Indonesian army, apparently not very happy to leave the territory and very angry after the international community, so trying to show their anger. But there was no casualty. It was just shots fired in the air. So it was a brief, if you want, a brief comeback of tension. But apparently the situation now is, of course, under control. There is still a lot of militia around. Interfaith has so far confiscated 600 weapons, traditional weapons. There are, of course, a lot of weapons still in East Timor, still in the capital, many refugees. So all that can create a situation that's not stable. But the Interfaith is increasing its presence. It's increasing the patrols. And, well, I wouldn't say there will not be any more explosion of violence. Of course, there might be still some violence, people shot, people killed maybe, but a big clash, it seems not. Well, it doesn't seem to be the case, because now the Indonesian army is forced to retreat. So they're not happy with that. They are burning the buildings. They are obliged to leave just before taking the ship of a plane back to Java or back to other islands of the archipelago. For instance, this afternoon, they burned a huge building in which was burnt in, let's say, 10 minutes, because it was full of petrol. And just before leaving, the Indonesian soldiers just burnt it. Well, they're not happy, but they are leaving because they don't have a choice, so they can still do some distraction, some hurt, but the worst we can hope is over for this country.
Marie-Pierre, just talking about your conditions working, apparently the Indonesian soldiers and their proxies, the militia, are turning their fire on unprotected reporters and photographers rather than the well-armed multinational soldiers. An Irish journalist reported that she heard a gunshot and felt the compression of a bullet pass her head. This in the last few days, British, Australian, and Indonesian troops retrieved two other journalists who'd been attacked. And then there was the killing of the reporter from Financial Times, Christian Science Monitor, in the last day.
Yes, that was a very, very bad day, actually. But you have to know that here, there are many places where you shouldn't go because it's very dangerous, either in Dili or out of Dili, of course. I mean, at the moment, out of Dili, there's just one road that can be taken, which is around 6 kilometers towards south. It's the only place where we can go and we can, there won't be an incident. So where the journalists were attacked, it's an area called Bekora, which is known to be an independentist area of Dili. It's a place we all know because we've all been there very often because it was full of independentists. It was one of the first targets, of course, of militia, pro-Indonesian militia, which have been the whole place. But now it's still militia around. And so when you go there, you have to be very careful. And these journalists went there alone on a motorbike in an afternoon. And normally you go there in the morning because normally the situation is safer in the morning. And so he was by himself. And that's not very careful at all. So this kind of thing can still happen if you just don't take the basic precautions. But it shows, of course, violence is still there, and journalists are not liked, and white people are not liked because they represent this democracy that was brought to East Timor. And so here, many people are not happy with that at all. But we can hope that it was the first and the last and the worst thing that happened recently to journalists here. But of course, sometimes the Indonesian soldiers, when you talk to them, answer very briefly and tell you, of course, we are living, because we are obliged to live. You all say the same thing. We are the bad guys. So, okay, we go, but you understand they don't like you, but they cannot really do many things against you, because now there are many interfaith soldiers around, and they cannot take the risk.
Marie-Pierre Vero, what are you hearing about West Timor? Because here you have hundreds of thousands of East Timorese who are forcibly deported there, but the troops, the peacekeeping forces, cannot go in there because it is Indonesia, and the very people that forced the Timorese in there are now running the camps. Will they let them go home?
That's a very, very big problem, because the estimations give between 100,000 and 200,000 people deported to West Timor, people who were taken in military trucks or in ships by soldiers or by militia armed with guns, so they had no choice. They are also reporting that in these groups of refugees there were some people were separated, the young men were taken to unknown places, and so most of the camps apparently are filled with more women and children. And no one can really go there. These camps are guarded by militia with guns, and they prevent contact with foreign people, with journalists, or with NGOs. And there are some reporting there are summary executions there in these camps. These people, the resistance people I met today, told us they want to come back, and some people who went to see them say all the same thing. They all want to come back to East Timor, but at the moment the frontier is closed by the Indonesian army. The interfaith has no intention in the coming days or weeks to go towards this frontier. They try to secure the roads towards south and east, which are supposedly easier to secure, but in the meantime, these people are lacking food, lacking medicine. They are forcibly displaced. There are some reporting they are forcibly displaced now towards other islands of the archipelago, which means thousands of kilometers from their country, and it will be impossible to track them there, to find them, and to enable them to come back in East Timor. So there's a very urgent action needed in West Timor, but unfortunately, the interfaith cannot go there because it is Indonesia.
We're talking to...
It's a sovereign part of a territory.
We're talking to Marie-Pierre Vero, who is a freelance journalist in Dili, East Timor. In fact, right now, the Australian-led forces are saying they're not going to allow other reporters in. Instead, they're going to fill their planes from Darwin, Australia, with food and other relief supplies. On that issue, Marie-Pierre, the issue of food and relief, as you were saying, there are many people still in the mountains. What needs to be done right now, and what is being done? Many people outside of East Timor have been condemning the major powers for not doing airdrops sooner to get water and food to the people forced into the mountains.
Yes, nothing is done, and nothing is done at the moment. And this morning I went to Dili, which is just 6-10 kilometers south of Dili, where there are between 54,000 people, who are people from Dili, who ran to these mountains to try to take refuge near a seminary and in the hills around. And these people, for 3 weeks, they haven't received anything, they don't have anything. They fortunately have water because of sources, of springs, but they don't have anything to eat. They can eat some manioc, they cook, but they lack rice, they lack medicine, they lack milk for the babies. They told us many babies had died because they didn't have milk to give to them. They just live on the ground and sleep on the ground. And in these hills, it's a bit cold in the evening, and some babies have also died because it was too cold up there for them. And this road now is secure. We went there, as a journalist went there. Now, interfaith has put people, soldiers, to look after the seminary, to ensure security. So the humanitarian aid can go to these refugees, but so far they haven't seen anyone. And they told us when we arrived this morning, but what are they doing? Why don't they come? We are dying. We need everything. And it's not so far. What are they doing? And it's a question we can ask. What are they doing? Why cannot they bring some convoys of rice, of food? And so yesterday some refugees went down to town, took their carriage to go back to take some rice, find some rice. They went to a governmental stockage place where they stole rice because it was that all dying of hunger up in the hills. So for the airdrops, apparently what the NGO are saying, it's not possible at the moment. It's too dangerous because the plane has to be too close to the ground, so they might be shot at. Well, that's very possible because many people still have guns. But you can send some cars, at least to the 50,000 refugees, and there's no problem of security there. Well, we know there are hundreds of thousands of refugees elsewhere in mountains where it's very difficult to reach. But this place close to Dili, I mean, I felt that like as a scandal this morning when I saw all these kids, all these people with nothing and waiting and receiving no food when it's possible to go there.
I think it's something when we read in the Western papers, like the New York Times, or I'm looking at a piece in the Washington Post, and it talks about the Timorese looters. Do you think it's fair to describe starving people as looters?
Oh, excuse me. As you notice, the line is not excellent. I didn't get the question.
There's a description of people breaking into government-owned food warehouse, describing them as looters. Do you think it's fair to describe people who are starving as looters?
Well, I wouldn't use this word because the people who came yesterday, when they come to this place where the rice was, and they told us this place was guarded by Australian soldiers. Well, the refugees told us, whether it's true or not, these soldiers are the one who opened the door for us. They opened the door so that we could take the rice. People had wanted to stop them. It was very easy to stop some groups of refugees who arrived with nothing and just to take rice, and after they've got very heavy bags of rice so they cannot run with that. And the soldiers just let them through because they certainly feel they need that. So I wouldn't say, of course, they are looters. They are just Timorese who were forced by violence, who lost everything. Their houses were burnt. Most of them don't know where their family are. They ask us, do you know where my brother is, where my sister is? Our family has been completely broken. Some of the people say they are dead. Others said they are in West Timor. So these people are in very stressful situation. They've lost everything. They've lost their family. And they've been starving for 3 weeks. And suddenly they listen, they maybe go to town because there are some soldiers there. Maybe it's more secure. They won't be killed. And they try to find some rice for the babies. I wouldn't say they are looters.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, and we hope to speak to you again soon. Our guest, Marie-Pierre Verreaux, who is a freelance journalist reporting for Radio France International in Dili, East Timor. Thank you for joining us. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move now to an issue closer to home. Today, the House Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution will hold a hearing on the State's Choice of Voting Systems Act, also known as H.R. 1173. The bill would allow states to elect their House members, their Congress members, in multi-seat districts, districts with more than one representative, as was done by most states in the 1790s and by some states as recently as 1968. With six co-sponsors, the legislation is sponsored by Congressmember Mel Watt, a Democrat of North Carolina, who's the ranking member of the Constitution Subcommittee, and he joins us now on Democracy Now! Welcome to the show, Congressmember Watt.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good. Well, we're going to need some explanation here because, unfortunately, the whole issue of proportional representation and any kind of different voting doesn't get very much play in this country. And so I don't think very many people understand it as a movement or what you're trying to do today.
Well, this is actually a very simple bill. All it would do is remove from the federal statute a provision that requires that congressional districts be drawn as single-member districts, and give states then the option of deciding whether it might be better in particular situations to have multi-member districts or continue to have single-member districts. That would allow the discussion of the pros and cons of alternative forms of voting systems to be moved from the federal platform down to the state platform, as long as the states could come up with a way to resolve this conflict in a way that does not run afoul of the Voting Rights Act.
Can you explain what you mean by multi-member districts?
Well, a multi-member district could be take two congressional districts, merge them into one congressional district with two seats to be filled. Take three single-member districts, merge it into one congressional district with three seats to be filled. Anything that has more than one member of Congress being elected from a district would be a multi-member district. And, of course, the states would continue to have the right or the option of having single-member districts also.
Not too long ago, New Mexico had Congress members who were at-large Congress members, right, who were elected for all of New Mexico. But what is the advantage of this? Why do you think it's more democratic?
Well, I don't contend that it's more democratic or less democratic. It is simply another option, and I think the states ought to have the option of having this discussion and evaluating the merits or lack of merits rather than having the federal government say to the states, this is the only way that you can do this. The bill really results from this history. Based on the 1990 census in North Carolina and a growing demand from the minority population, which I am a member of and supported, we actively encouraged the North Carolina State Legislature to create majority black districts, because history had shown us for almost 100 years that minority candidates were not able to get elected in districts that were not either majority black or substantially or had a substantial minority of black people in them. Bottom line, white citizens in North Carolina were not tending to vote for minority candidates. So that resulted in almost 100 years of not having a minority representative in Congress from North Carolina, when the overall population of minorities in North Carolina is between 22% and 25%. And we thought that was unfair because minorities were simply not getting a shot. So the legislature in North Carolina drew two majority black districts, and immediately people started charging that when you have majority black districts, you polarize black people and white people into single-member districts, and you polarize liberal people and conservative people into different districts, and people have less influence, and there's less discussion over with people whose views may disagree with them or whose race may disagree with them. And this bill really is a concession that there is some truth to that. And if there are ways to both encourage a level playing field for minority candidates and the ability of minority candidates to get elected, and decrease polarization, either racial polarization or political polarization or philosophical polarization, then I think we have an obligation to discuss those possible ways of doing that. And that's all this really would enable. It would enable the state legislatures to have that discussion, evaluate the pros and cons of having single versus multi-member districts or a combination thereof, and make its own evaluation of whether this assists with having a better democracy or does not assist with having a better democracy.
We're talking to North Carolina Democratic Congressmember Melvin Watt, who is holding a hearing today on a bill known as H.R. 1173, the State's Choice of Voting Systems Act, which would allow states to elect U.S. House members in multi-seat districts. We are going to break for stations to identify themselves, and when we come back, just for a few minutes, we'll also be joined by Robert Ritchie, Executive Director of the Center for Voting and Democracy. Stay with us here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with this discussion on a different kind of proportional representation being recommended by North Carolina Congressmember Melvin Watt, holding a hearing today on the State's Choice of Voting Systems Act. Robert Ritchie, also with us, Executive Director of the Center for Voting and Democracy. Congressmember Melvin Watt, how much support do you have for your bill?
I can't tell you that I really know that. Today's discussion, I suspect, will be more a constitutional, intellectual, philosophical exploration of whether this is a good or a bad idea, and whether the state should have this right. If out of that discussion and hearing today there emerges a sense of greater support, I think we will know that. If out of this discussion today we find that this is a terrible idea, then I think we will know that. We can either decide whether to aggressively pursue the bill to try to get it voted on and considered, or we can decide to abandon this effort and not worry with it anymore. That's why you have a hearing to help to edify the sponsors and possible supporters and amplify the arguments both for and against.
Congressmember Melvin Watt of North Carolina, also Robert Ritchie of the Center for Voting and Democracy. You've been working on this issue for a long time. Can you put Congressmember Watt's bill in the context of the greater proportional representation movement?
Yeah, thanks, Amy. Well, we are certainly very interested to see how this hearing goes. And I was just looking over the witness list, and the first witness is Tom Campbell, a California Republican, who is a sponsor of the bill. And there are some Republicans on the bill, and I think it's up to 16 at this point. And I think they we'll see if the discussion does generate the greater support that Congressman Watt was talking about. I think that having a Campbell on the bill does tell us something, that he had direct experience with cumulative voting, one of these proportional, semi-proportional systems that has been used and is being used in this country right now. And the folks who had that experience with cumulative voting in Illinois, that's where he grew up, really seemed to like the system. And it's something that hasn't been done for other state legislative elections in the U.S., but here we have one direct use of it, and you have a range of people thinking that that it worked well. And I think where we are right now as we go into the new century, as is being discussed quite a bit, and is that I think people are beginning to say, well, is geography the paramount feature of what our representation should be about? So thinking about Congressman Watt's situation in North Carolina and the controversies over his first district that were raised by the Shaw v. Reno case, you know, are blacks in Charlotte more connected to whites in Charlotte, or might they be more connected to blacks in Durham, you know, far across the state? And the first district, you know, had a, some people would say, a functional compactness in that it connected a lot of black voters who did have a lot of common interests, even though they didn't necessarily live next to one another. And I think there was a real coherence to that district, but it certainly didn't look very coherent and it didn't look compact. And I think that is a little bit of an insight into the fact that a lot of us these days have communities of interest that aren't necessarily just connected to who we live next to, you know, and proportional systems allow us to join with others and define our own representation even if we don't happen to live next to one another. And there's a whole range of options, and I think this debate will perhaps get some of those on the table.
Congressmember Melvin Watt, if people are listening who care about this issue, what can they do to support your legislation? What kind of effect can they have?
Well, I think they can write to their first of all, I would encourage them to listen to this debate, get from their member of Congress a transcript, write to us to request a transcript of the hearing, get the testimony, and make a reasoned evaluation of whether this is a good or a bad idea. If they think it's a good idea, then I think it would be helpful for them to write to their respective member of Congress and call this bill to their attention. We get inundated with a number of bills, exorbitant number of bills, and we tend not to evaluate those bills unless we get correspondence or contacts from our own constituents. And so if people start writing to their member of Congress, then the member of Congress will take the time to look at the bill, evaluate it, and decide whether he or she thinks it's a good idea to become a co-sponsor or to support the bill. And that's the way you build support for bills. I don't have a hidden agenda here. I think we have an obligation to try to make our democracy work as well as we can possibly make it work. And I think this notion of requiring states to have single-member districts may run counter to that, although I am not one that's going to go out and say every state ought to convert its system to a multi-member system or every state ought to have cumulative voting. I think each state just simply deserves the right to have their own state legislature engage in this debate and make their own choice. And this is the ideal time to do it because you're coming up on a new census, and there's going to be a lot of discussion about how you do redistricting based on the new census. And if we don't have the discussion and states don't have the option this time, then it'll be 10 more years before they have that option again.
And, Amy, can I just add a couple of quick points? I mean, we've been talking about proportional representation, and this bill is really not about proportional representation, though of course, our organization, as one that likes those systems, is very interested in the bill because it would allow states to look at proportional systems with other options. But that, just to put it in context, you know, most other mature democracies, I mean, the great majority of mature democracies use proportional systems of some sort or another. They tend to have turnout that, compared to our 1998 national turnout in congressional elections, is more than twice the turnout. They tend to have more than twice the representation of women that we have. And that, there's just a more of a kind of a free market politics as far as, candidates and parties having to have, sort of ongoing competition rather than the kind of elections we had last year where, you know, more than one-fifth of congressional races were not contested, more than two-fifths of state legislative races were not contested, and that, you know, as we go into redistricting, which is such a politically political power game, and one where the public is often left out of the table and their interests, that these proportional systems as kind of a political reform movement, I think that we're seeing more and more interest. A National Organization for Women just this weekend is going to be voting on a resolution to support these systems and have their branches study it. The NAACP is looking at it. Common Cause chapters in different states are looking at it. So we're really, you know, I think seeing a growing foment of interest, and certainly the time is right because redistricting is the time to have this debate.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Rob Ritchie, Executive Director of the Center for Voting Democracy, Voting and Democracy, and North Carolina Congress member Melvin Watt, who will be holding his hearing today on H.R. 1173. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move now into our last segment, Latino groups this week are staging a boycott, which they call a brownout, against the major broadcast networks, which they say lack diversity and ethnic sensitivity in their programming. This comes as NBC this week edited a racial slur against Latinos from its sitcom Will and Grace, a show about the friendship between a straight woman and a gay man, both of whom are white. This week's episode originally contained a dialogue sequence in which Grace, one of the main characters, calls her Salvadoran maid a tamale. The show was edited and aired with the word honey instead. In the cut we're about to play, Grace is in her bedroom speaking with the maid, Rosario, who's just married an American citizen in order to obtain a green card.
This is my penthouse view.
Did you say my name?
No, I said this is my penthouse view, but I understand it sounds exactly like Rosario.
You know, you never talked to me this way before we were married.
Sorry, Rosie, I'm still a little tense about our conjugal bed.
Squash you like a wormy apple.
I hate it here, Karen. I want to be in the good part of the house with you.
Well, that's sweet, Jack, but this is where the help stays.
But I'm not help.
Honey, you married help, you're help.
That is just an excerpt of the program Will and Grace on NBC. We're joined right now by Alex Nogales, who is national spokesperson for National Hispanic Media Coalition, which is one of the key organizations involved in the brownout against the major networks. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Alex.
Thank you so much.
Your response?
Sorry?
Your response to what you were just listening to.
Well, it's very typical of the networks to be insensitive, to be racist. We saw it in the fact that 26 new shows were announced for the fall, and not a single one had a Latino or another person of color in a leading role, even a secondary role. So it is quite common. You know, in context of what we're talking about, this is minor, because what we're really talking about is this blatant racism that is being practiced by an industry that prides itself on being very, very liberal. But in fact, it's very, very conservative in terms of its hiring practices. What it really comes out to is that people of color cannot work in Hollywood, not in front of camera and not in back of camera.
What kind of response have you gotten? I tried to get the networks to come on today to speak with you. CBS said they wouldn't come on, though talked extensively to me off the record. NBC didn't return the call. I know Jesse Jackson met with CBS Brass yesterday, the CEO of CBS. What are they saying to you?
They're not saying anything to us as of yet. They will. because it is, we are a good business. We're a good business for this nation because we're 12% of the U.S. population. African Americans are 13. You have Asian Americans who are 3.5. Native Americans who are 1%. We're almost 30% of the U.S. population. And when you consider the fact that we're talking about free TV, the number of eyeballs that are watching the tube are closer to 35-37%. Now, they cannot for a very long, prolonged period of time continue to deny this audience opportunity in that industry. At a certain point, I expect that the advertisers are going to look at them and say, what's wrong with you? This is, you're costing us money, you're costing us business. And remember that Hollywood is not only making product for the United States, it is also making product for a very mature market, which is Latin America. It isn't China, which is still an immature market, but it is Latin America. So it stands to reason that long-term, people that are bilingual, that are bicultural, can add a great deal to the strategy.
What does a brownout exactly mean, and how will the networks register this?
Here's what a brownout is. What we're asking our people is to take conscience of the fact that we're demonstrated against these four networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox, for their racist behavior and racist hiring practices. What we're asking our people to do is to observe the fact that this has happened. Now, we don't expect that the ratings are going to move much because the fact of the matter is that we're not represented proportionally in the Nielsen ratings as well. But what we do expect to do is the same thing that Cesar Chavez did during the grape strike, and that is we're going to bring in the loyalty factor. Latinos and other people of color are very loyal to the products that they consume. They're very loyal to the networks that they see. They're very loyal to programming. And so what we're asking to people over a period of time is to tune out. If, in fact, these offending networks are closing the doors of opportunity based on ethnicity, based on racism, then what we're saying is we don't have to watch these stations, we don't have to watch these products. We can go elsewhere to where we are wanted, where the doors of opportunity are open, to where, in fact, we can grow and develop as any community has to.
What role are Latino actors playing in fighting the networks right now for more representation?
A very big one, and a very big one. And I have to tell you that we're in a two-track system. It isn't just one community, the Latino community, as you know. It is really all four communities, Asian American, Native American, and African American, that have in fact banded together and understood that there is a common interest and that there's a common concern, and that in fact this is a fight that we're going to take on together, because no one community can do it by itself. When you've got 35-37% of the eyeballs of America watching these four networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox, that's considerable power. So what we're doing is coming to a grand coalition as we never have before. Historically, this is a first, and in fact, putting this kind of pressure on the networks. And it's going to continue. Each minority group, each ethnic group, time after time, is going to take its turn at announcing its own action, and it will follow the lines of the brownout.
What can people do who are listening right now?
What people can do is tune out. Tune out, and it isn't just about these four ethnic groups. It is about progressive people in America who are about opportunity, are about fairness, are about a level playing field, so that, in fact, the change that has to come to this industry that is so racist comes about. We're not living in South Africa, and they're acting as if we were. And so what we're asking to people is to tune out, and if you will, take a moment and write a letter to the CEO of one of the offending corporations, ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox, and let them know that you don't appreciate their comportment and their behavior.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Alex Nogales, for joining us from the National Hispanic Media Coalition. If people want to reach you, where can they call or go on the web?
They can call us at A. Nogales at earthlink.com.
That's A. Nogales at earthlink.com. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Our engineer today, Bernard White. You can reach us by email at democracy@pacifica.org. Tomorrow, a primer on Columbia. Monday, we'll talk with Charlie Kernighan about Kathy Lee Gifford's sweatshop in Central America. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!